Now he reached for Mary's hand and laid down his fork. He could not eat, though he could not remember the last time he or any of them had eaten. Mary was gazing at him with that same flat expression she had greeted him with at the door when he returned from the Vanderveers. Until today, he had never seen her this way. Not when she had assisted him at his first amputation at the Union Hotel Hospital, nor at Antietam either, where he had taught her to perform the operation herself out of the overwhelming imperative to save men's lives. Mary had seen the worst of everything, and yet this was worse still. War had found them all. Again. Amelia, as always, allowed them their moment, holding back her own suffering, though her eyes were glazed and red-rimmed. She had moved through the afternoon like an apparition. Amelia, whom Albany relied on to deliver their babies, who had worked all her life for good, who tirelessly went wherever need beckoned, now stared unseeing across the table. For women who rushed headlong into the disasters of others, there was no one now to rush headlong into theirs. They had only each other. Elizabeth was staring into the distance. Amelia had shadowed her granddaughter all afternoon. For a while, Elizabeth had been inconsolable, though more than twice she raged that her weeping was of no help. "Why?" she kept asking. But Amelia had no answer for the perpetual, unanswerable question of why. Nor did William, who had long ago decided that humanity never learned anything at all, and that philosophy failed at everything necessary. Solace, explanation, reparation. Mary could only shake her head. Whatever presence of mind had driven her meticulous repair of Emma had now deserted her. The enormity of the abomination had paralyzed them all. Separately, they were each recalling the events of the last several days. On Wednesday morning, they had buried David and Bonnie and erected the stone for the girls. On Thursday, one of the prostitutes had revived their hopes that the girls might be alive. For four nights running, Mary and William had roamed through Albany's streets, searching for them. Last night, they had braved a social outing at the Vanderveers, worked all night at the hospital. And then this morning, Tuesday, miraculously, the girls had come home. Time had stretched 7 days into an illusion of weeks and weeks. Amelia was picking at a seam on the sleeve of her dress, loosening a thread. "Our girls," she whispered, her voice subdued and pained. "Morphine," Mary said dazedly. Medicine was her comforting familiar. She could face anything in the calm recitation of medical facts. "I'll have to wean them from it." She was speaking in measured, preoccupied tones. "They can't stay on the drug long. I could use chloral if they need to sleep. Then willow bark tea for Emma until she heals. I'll keep watching for syphilis and gonorrhea." At this, Amelia shuddered. "But I saw no indication of either, and if they aren't fulminant now, it's unlikely they'll develop. Her molesters must have been fastidious. Safes, etc." "Mary," Amelia said, "have a care for Elizabeth." Elizabeth shook her head. "Thank you, Grandmama, but I am not a child." "Whatever possessed you, Lizzie," Amelia said, "to think of playing for the girls? We're so grateful to you." "I didn't think." Elizabeth said she had no memory of disinterring her violin from its dusty case under the bed, or of rubbing rosin on the bow. She had come to herself on the veranda, grasping the violin by its neck, her fingers automatically turning its pegs to tune the instrument. And then music had floated through the air, and the blank, terrified look had disappeared from Emma's and Claire's eyes.
"Lost in a blizzard. Saved by a flood," William mused.
He turned to Mary.
"Claire was really untouched?"
"Yes," Mary said. She pushed away her empty plate. "I think it's possible that she was deliberately spared." They all tried to come to terms with the malevolent deliberation necessary to spare one girl while harming another, and couldn't.
"It's odd, though, isn't it?" William said, shaking his head.
"It's no mystery," Mary said. "Emma is 10. She's at the age of consent." Amelia removed her spectacles and laid them on the table. She had seen a lot in her years of intimacy with the world. In houses high and low, many private terrors had revealed their secrets to her. But none like this.
"The horror of it," she whispered.
She looked outside, where the gloaming had burned itself out.
"We are none of us innocents, the three of us," she said. "We know what happens. We should have looked harder."
"I wanted to," Elizabeth said.
"But we did look," William said.
His pronouncement was not enough absolution for any of them, though it was hard to imagine how much harder they could have looked without forcing their way through every door in Albany. Still, it was impossible to escape the devastation of having, in essence, buried the girls when they had been alive and in desperate need. All four privately entertained the appalling notion that they were glad that Bonnie was dead, because they didn't think she could have faced this.
"Where could they have been all this time?" Elizabeth said.
William shook his head. Earlier, before he'd been called away to the Vanderveers, he and Officer Farrell had discussed that very thing. Farrell already had plans to ask around in the pastures, since that was where he had found the girls, but he warned William that the floodwaters would likely wash away any evidence.
"And Bonnie and David," Amelia said, her voice catching.
She felt the need to tally every wrong, to list every insurmountable hurdle ahead.
"We have to tell Emma and Claire."
She dreaded telling them. They all did. How to tell brutalized children that the people they most wanted, most needed, were no longer alive? Mothers who birthed stillborns asked about their dead infants only when they were ready to hear what they already instinctively knew. When Emma and Claire might be ready to learn they were orphans, no one could imagine. Amelia tried to picture telling them, and couldn't even conjure the words. Mary lifted her head, her gaze direct, new life showing in her eyes.
"How did we miss them that day?"
"What do you mean?" William said.
"The teacher said she let the students out around noon. We left the house about then. How did we miss seeing them? They couldn't have made it far, not on their own."
William shook his head.
"And?"
"They didn't get lost, William."
She rose from the table as the anger she'd held at bay all day washed over her.
"Someone took them. Someone deliberately took them."
There was a knock at the front door, and a tearful Vera went to answer it.
"We should tell no one," William warned. "I didn't tell the Vanderveers earlier. We don't want to expose the girls to more scrutiny than is necessary. And we don't know who did it. We need to keep them safe."
And besides, they all thought, how did one announce a resurrection? Vera returned and said that Jacob Vanderveer was at the door.
"Jacob," William said, rising. "Is he ill?"
"No. He wants to speak to Elizabeth."
"Elizabeth?"
They all turned to her.
"Do you want to, Lizzie?" Amelia said.
She did. She went to the door and slipped outside onto the veranda,
where Jacob was sitting on the swing, bundled in a woolen topcoat, a thick muffler wrapped around his neck, black leather gloves covering his hands. He rose when she came out.
"What is it?" Jacob said. "Something's happened, hasn't it? During the flood?"
He took her by the elbow and drew her to him, a gesture that yesterday would have been a liberty, but in this newly upended life seemed more than permissible. They sat down together on the swing.
"Did you lose someone?"
She shook her head.
"Tell me, please," he asked.
"Someone I love is hurt."
"Your aunt? Uncle? Not your grandmother?"
"No, not them."
"I'm happy to hear that. I like them all very much. But I am sorry about whoever this is. Will they be all right?"
That was the question, the essential thing.
"I don't know,"
she said. "I am sorry. I don't mean to..."
He pulled a handkerchief from his coat and handed it to her.
"Thank you. I've gone stupid with weeping. You will think I weep all the time."
He shook his head.
"Of course not."
The sun was going down. She shut her eyes against the tears, but they came anyway. She dabbed at her eyes with his handkerchief. He did not ask her any more questions, and she was grateful for his reticence. They sat swaying on the swing together. Elizabeth turned suddenly.
"I forgot. Uncle William told us about your ordeal. How are you? Are you well?"
Jacob indicated his muffler with his gloved hand.
"Still frozen. But I'm fine. No lasting effects that I can tell."
"He said you ran across the ice."
"I did. The office seemed about to cave in. I thought I had to, if I wanted to live."
"Did you have to?"
"I don't know. Father hasn't been down yet to inspect the damage. There are reports that the river is already receding. We'll know soon enough whether I was foolish or prudent. Father was hurt too, though he went out this afternoon. Where, I'm not sure."
"I can't believe you crossed the ice."
"Desperation breeds action."
His smile was self-deprecating, endearing. He glanced away and then back again.
"There's something else, too. Something I want to tell you."
The night watchman was crossing the street, a lantern and a duffel in his hands. He set them down on the sidewalk and hauled the creaking wrought iron park gates shut. From the duffel, he pulled out a long chain and padlock and went to work closing up the park. Jacob said,
"Now I'll have to walk around."
"It seems so."
"Elizabeth, when I was stranded on that rooftop, I thought only of two people. My mother and you. I don't know whether I was about to die or not. I may never know. But all night, all I could think about was what a shame it would be if I didn't get to see you again. And this afternoon, all I could think was that I wanted you to understand that. Under any other circumstance, what I am about to say would be too forward. But now I've learned how brief a thing life can be. I think you are extraordinary."
He held up his hand as she opened her mouth to dissuade him.
"I'm not talking about your violin playing. Not even your beauty. Well, perhaps some of it is your beauty."
He smiled ruefully.
"But I think you were very courageous. You were young when you went to Paris, and yet you survived Monsieur Gerard's tyranny. I admire you very much."
She shook her head.
"I hardly survived. And you don't know how much you exaggerate. Someone else..."
"No one would have lasted as long."
"I doubt that."
"I adore you, Elizabeth. I've met no one else like you. So you must suffer my adoration. Will you?"
His gaze was insistent and kind and even, yes, adoring.
You don't know me very well,
she said. But I want to get to know you well. Will you let me?
Your experience has made you precipitate.
I won't deny it. But what does that matter? May I return tomorrow to see you? We'll have to think of something to do other than the ice regatta. And besides, everyone's sleds were lost in the flow.
Forgive me, but I can't see you tomorrow.
Of course. I'm sorry, I don't mean to press. But you must get out sometime. May I call later this week to walk with you in the park? She nodded. Excellent. And he rose and took his leave. Chapter 25. That evening, in his book-lined study, Garrett seized the scotch decanter from the walnut sideboard and poured himself and Jacob each a glassful. Garrett hadn't changed out of the work clothes he'd donned to go out earlier. His pants' hems were crusted with mud, his canvas shirt sweated through. The bandage on his forehead was ragged and blood-stained. He handed Jacob a glass and motioned him toward the worn leather armchairs that framed the large fireplace. Several logs crackled on the hearth, and the andirons glowed red. Jacob was grateful for the warmth. After returning from Elizabeth's, he still hadn't removed his muffler. Having summoned Jacob, Garrett now proceeded to ignore him, staring off into the middle distance with the distracted air of someone who had forgotten his way. Surely, Jacob thought, his father was only gathering his energies to somehow call him to task for the hole in the office roof, or for not saving more of their lumber. Jacob hoped not. His visit to Elizabeth, wonderful as it had been, had sapped his energy, and he was ravenous, a function of being exposed to the extreme cold, Dr. Stipp had warned him. The smell of roast beef wafted up the stairs, and with it the earthy scent of roasted potatoes and turnips, a fine dinner that reflected his father's taste. Now Garrett turned his gaze on Jacob.
Your mother said you went to the Stipps.
I wanted to tell Elizabeth something.
I would think you would have spent the day asleep after the night you had. So, does this mean that you are still taken with her?
Very much. Garrett nodded and lifted his glass to study the refractions of the fire through the cut crystal.
Any repercussions for them from the flood?
They seem to have had a bit of a shock.
Shock?
Garrett cocked his head, his eyes observant now.
Were they upset about your mishap?
No, about someone else's, apparently. His father shifted in his seat, concerned.
About whom?
She didn't say, and I didn't pry. I probably shouldn't have told you.
Ah, Jacob the Reticent. It's good of you to keep a confidence.
Jacob felt slightly ashamed at this compliment, as if it were really an insult. He changed the subject. Why did you go out? Dr. Stipp wanted you to stay in.
I went to see Harley, and then someone had to see about the district. I wanted to see how much trouble we were in. The reports were true. The water is receding fast. If you'd waited another few hours, a boat could have reached you.
Another few hours, and I might have been dead. Garrett dismissed this sentiment with a wave. As sanguine as he had been earlier with Elizabeth, Jacob hated having to defend himself to his father, or impress on him the extremity of his situation. Walking home around the park from the Stipps, the thought of what could have happened had overwhelmed him. In the moment, he had not hesitated to go out on the ice, but the whole thing had been fraught with immense danger. He had been lucky, and not a little foolish to attempt it. But he was alive. And also, he realized now, furious. Harley's abdication of his responsibility had been nagging at him all day. Where had the man been? 100 other workers had flooded into the district, and Harley had never shown.
Did you find out where Harley disappeared to during the ice break?
His father took a sip of the scotch, keeping his eyes fixed on Jacob.
No. He was heavily medicated. In pain. He took quite a blow.
If he had met me in the district like I thought he was going to, I wouldn't have been stranded. I could have gone for the books right away and gotten out.
Nonetheless, Harley's a hero, Garrett said. No one can figure out how he got hurt. He might have been unconscious for hours.
He set his emptied glass on a side table, resting his case. Perhaps, and I'm sorry he's hurt, but why did he go home first instead of going straight to the district?
I don't know. He must have had a good reason.
Jacob looked away. His father and Harley together were a bulwark. Jacob's entrance after Harvard into their tight alliance had caused resentment on Harley's part, though his father had dismissed Jacob's concern as imaginary. Jacob touched his glass, balancing at the end of his armrest. He kept his tone light. And where were you, father?
Damn, this thing itches,
Garrett said, ripping off the bandage on his forehead and revealing the thin red line of his gash and the garish stitches holding it closed. He tossed it into the fire.
I want to know where you were, Jacob said.
All at once, his exhaustion fell away and was replaced by pure, unfiltered rage. Garrett glared at Jacob, and his voice turned harsh and remonstrating.
Where was I? Right behind you. But first we had to say goodbye to our guests, and then you'd taken the good carriage, so the other one had to be harnessed and readied, because your mother wanted to come, and that took time too.
He waved a hand in irritation.
A cloak, her hat, some warm gloves. It was interminable. Do you know how long it takes to get her to move? Hours.
You could have ridden Dolly. You could have been there when the district started to flood. I was alone. It was impossible to do everything by myself. He never opposed his father absolutely. All his life he'd been careful, respectful, and fearful of exposing his mother to the explosive tirades his father displayed at work, when labor mistakes or shipping problems, things outside of his control, upended his expectations. Jacob doubted he'd protected his mother from much, not when a sherry decanter had become her comfort and confidant.
I thought you were coming to help. You did well enough without me. You abandoned me, but you saved yourself. Son, all this complaining is out of character. Be proud.
Jacob was about to press for a better explanation, but he checked himself. He couldn't tell whether his father was being obtuse or deliberately misunderstanding him. And if he had come, perhaps they both would have been caught, and would his father have been able to manage the ice? He doubted it. He decided to change the subject.
How much lumber did we save? Jacob said. Could you tell? We filled at least one of the barges. Did you find any of them? I didn't go downstream. And by the time the riverfront and roads dry and we retrieve whatever inventory we can, we may spend the last penny in our coffers.
I don't think so. Not since I last worked on the books, but I can look tonight.
No need.
His father shrugged.
I'll do it.
The books were Jacob's responsibility, though Garrett understood the business far better than Jacob, who had a good hold on it himself. Lumber was a great generator of cash, but it was also a seasonal commodity, and profits were dependent upon a steady flow of product, which was in turn dependent upon a thousand other things, not the least of which was ready access to one's inventory and a navigable Hudson, which they didn't have, and wouldn't for a while. They sold most of their lumber downriver, in Manhattan City, and beyond, as far as Boston and Europe, which they would not be able to do for at least a month.
I can find excess revenue somewhere.
Jacob recalled some outstanding receipts they could call in, if necessary. Manhattanites tended to be delinquent on their bills unless pressed.
Not to worry, Jacob. We are better off than most. You saved those books, and I've got them now. Nothing for you to concern yourself with. Your job is to feel better.
A maid tapped on the door jamb and knotted her hands together in the nervous tic that Jacob had noticed all the maids exhibited when they encountered his father.
Mrs. Vanderveer is waiting for you at table, she said.
Her face registered no disapproval of the clumps of dried mud that had fallen from Garrett's pants onto the Turkish rug, even though she or someone else would have to deal with it as soon as he exited the room. At table, Viola made no mention of Garrett's attire, and to Jacob's relief, his mother seemed much more self-possessed than she usually did at this late hour, her gestures more deliberate. Tonight, no sherry glass glimmered in the candlelight. No decanter stood in wait on the pantry sideboard. He caught his mother's eye, and she looked up from her plate and nodded confirmation to his silent inquiry. Dinner often passed like this for them, in mute conversations of subtle nods and glances. Garrett never noticed, and he didn't again tonight.
Why didn't you order champagne, Viola? Both of your beloveds have been rescued from Poseidon's grasp. That's worth celebrating, isn't it?
Of course, Viola said, and rang the bell.
Later, when she refused to drink even a drop, Garrett finished the bottle himself and had to be carried to bed. Chapter 26. The next morning, Mary woke to sun streaming through the window of the girl's bedroom. She had slept in an armchair that William had brought up from the parlor. The sour vapor of sleep still permeated the room, though at some point during the long night, she had cracked open a window. At midnight, when Emma and Claire had stirred, Mary had administered a third dose of narcotic. Above all, she believed they needed rest, because consciousness carried its own dangers, weighted down with intolerable realities, people often gave up. And memory had a way of feeding itself, starving it through insensibility, interrupting it for a short while, would delay recollection, and she wanted to avoid a repeat of yesterday morning's hysteria. Mary pulled a shawl over her shoulders and went to the girls' bedside, trying not to wake them. The two sisters lay entwined and inert under the counterpane, their lips and cheeks reassuringly pink, their breathing measured and deep. The strands of their copper hair were damp with perspiration and seemed darker somehow. How much lasting damage the two would suffer was impossible to determine. Over the years, Mary had discovered that the hardest part of being a physician was to wait for possibility to become fact, for the corporeal to repair or declare itself, for a rested soul to emerge from a wounded body, or not. William brought her a cup of tea and reported that it was 8:30. Farmers' wagons and carriages were already bustling up and down the avenue, punctuated by the periodic percussions of the sledgehammers still pounding away on the row houses. And still the girls slept on. Amelia and Elizabeth looked in, and they all took turns going down to the kitchen to eat breakfast. Toward 10, they were all there when first Emma's, then Claire's eyes blinked open. They seemed to register nothing of where they were, an effect, no doubt, of the medication. Their bodies roused one limb at a time, first a twitching finger, then a jerk of an elbow, then a shifting leg, until finally they drew themselves sleepily up in bed, their eyes filmed with a glazed, wary numbness. To Mary's repeated assurances, "You remember us, Auntie Amelia, Aunt Mary, Elizabeth, Uncle William. We're taking care of you. You're safe. We love you." Emma and Claire said nothing, and they were careful not to draw attention to themselves. Claire's small hand brushed sleep from her eyes, her pale face an unreadable mask. From time to time, she laid her head on her sister's shoulder. They both held themselves very still. It was the stillness of a wary hope, a kind of disbelief that mistrusted itself. Everyone defaulted to doing concrete tasks, except William, who pretended to read a book in the corner out of fear that his maleness would frighten them. Elizabeth fetched food, buttered bread, and chicken broth. Amelia poured tea. Mary tucked a sheet here, smoothed a wrinkle there, while observing the girls out of the corner of her eye, relieved that they displayed no signs of nausea from the morphine. Emma and Claire accepted these ministrations with a wary eye, withdrawing into themselves at any quick gesture. Even the moving of a dish or a walk across a floor threatened. Emma grimaced whenever she extended a leg or shifted in bed. She had not yet discovered her stitches. Claire pulled Emma close and whispered into her ear, and Emma shook her head. Her eyes, large and round, were socketed above a bony expanse of high cheekbone and deep hollows. Like Claire's, Emma's face was all architectural angle and spare beauty, unmarred even by the yellowing bruise on one cheekbone. Mary could see Emma sorting the past from the present, trying to decide what and who to trust. She recognized the vigilance. Recovering soldiers at Antietam had followed her movements with the same heedful gaze. Whoever had taken the girls shackled them still. How much to push? Stories of pain never came out straight. They emerged in bits and pieces, and only when the teller could tolerate the telling. Soldiers she had treated often relived their experiences in distracted and disconnected tales that made little sense to anyone but them. Push them too hard, and they broke. Fail to push them enough, and they receded into darkness. Getting to the center of the pain to alleviate it, to free it, took a deft touch. No one knew exactly what to do, or what to say. It was then that Elizabeth gathered her skirts and sat on the edge of the girl's bed. They looked at her with widening eyes, moving even closer together. Elizabeth cleared her throat. Once upon a time, not very long ago, a dragon who lived in a dark cave found two wonderful little sisters. He was greedy and mean and wouldn't let them go outside. He hurt them and scared them and said that no one cared about them anymore. Emma and Claire turned rapt and attentive. Everyone listened in amazement. Elizabeth was compiling her story from clues, from the girl's pale skin and darkened hair, their mute terror. But the dragon was wrong. People who loved them searched and searched. Days and weeks went by. To the girls, it seemed like a very long time. They began to lose hope. They feared all was lost. But these were clever girls, smart girls, like you, Emma and Claire. One night, they were strong enough and smart enough to escape. They ran out into the night, into the streets. Bells were ringing, and it was so loud, and they were very afraid, and they didn't know what to do. They didn't know where they were. Clever Elizabeth was weaving in details they had gleaned from Officer Farrell. Then, a good policeman found them and brought them to a safe place. A house a lot like this one. But the sisters were still frightened. What if they said the wrong thing, and the dragon found them again? But I want you to believe me now, girls. That dragon can't ever find you again. You're safe now. Do you understand? Claire nodded, an incremental dip of the chin that would hardly register as agreement in anyone else. She nudged Emma, and Emma, her voice scratchy from deep sleep, turned wordlessly to Claire. They looked at one another for a long time before Emma turned and said,
"Where are Mama and Papa?"
For the eternity of several seconds, no one said anything. Elizabeth, so competent a moment ago, could find nothing now to say. Amelia stepped in, kneeling on the floor and reaching for the girl's hands. She said,
"Do you remember the big storm? The one when you got lost? Well, your mama and papa got lost, too."
"Did the other man find them?"
Claire said.
"The other man?"
Amelia said, assuming the measured cadence of the master midwife, who had captained hundreds of women through every shoal of labor, and who confronted every disastrous surprise as if it were no surprise at all. Emma put a restraining arm on Claire, but Claire persisted.
"The one who found us. The bad man. Why didn't he find Mama and Papa?"
"The bad man?"
"The one who hurt Emma,"
Claire said. Emma tried to silence Claire with a hand to her mouth, but Claire pulled it away.
"There were two men? A bad one and a good one?"
Amelia's steadfast control did not falter, even as Mary and William glanced at one another. Two men?
"Did the bad one find Mama and Papa like he did us?"
Amelia said, "No, Claire. No, sweetheart. No one found them." Claire said,
"But where are they?"
She turned to her sister.
"Emma? Emma? Where are they?"
For Claire, there was no leap of understanding. Couldn't be one. She was too young. Emma could no longer meet Claire's eyes. She looked as if she were detaching herself from any further responsibility, as if she had claimed too much before, and was now exhausted from the effort, and could no longer summon the energy to perform one more act of succor for her little sister. She shut her eyes as Claire tugged at her sleeve, imploring her to answer. When Emma opened her eyes again, it was in wide-eyed supplication for Amelia's intercession. "Claire," Amelia coaxed, "do you want to come with me? Come with Elizabeth and me. I'll tell you everything. But we'll go outside to the veranda. It's pretty outside. We'll swing. Do you remember the swing? We can talk, and Elizabeth will play her violin. Won't you, Elizabeth?"
"Of course I will."
Claire looked at Emma for permission.
"Don't worry, Emma. I'll go with them," William said. "You don't need to be brave anymore. We are all here to be brave for you. She'll be safe. I promise."
He was not a man who gambled, but he was gambling now, all of them hoping that Emma would relinquish Claire to his custody. What trust she could invoke for any man, even one she had called uncle all her life, was unknowable. It was a gamble they all hoped Emma would take, but it was by no means certain that she would. Emma's glazed eyes focused on William, as if she were contemplating every possible outcome of letting Claire go. Then she nodded imperceptibly. William gave her no chance to rethink her decision. He knelt beside Claire and scooped her up from Emma's side and carried her out the door, swaddling her in a blanket as they went, while Elizabeth and Amelia trailed behind. Mary took Elizabeth's place at the edge of the bed. Soon the strains of a Mozart lullaby came through the window, but Emma did not respond to the music. There was not a flicker of relief. Mary wondered what strength or despair it took for a young girl not to cry after she'd learned her parents had died. I know we aren't your mama and papa, Mary said, but you will never be alone. I promise.
You'll live here.
And we'll do everything to help you. We love you and Claire very much. Emma lay back down and dragged a pillow over her face and drew her legs into the fetal position. We all will take care of you. Last night, I gave you medicine to help you sleep and to help with the pain. I can give you more now. You can sleep. I promise nothing will happen to Claire. And nothing will happen to you either, except that you'll be safe with us. I will be here, or Amelia, or Elizabeth. Always. Emma made small, indecipherable sounds. Pardon? Mary said, leaning down to listen.
He said.
But her voice drifted off.
Who said? The other man.
The man who hurt you? She nodded.
He said that I needed him. That I'd miss him if he wasn't always with me.
Deep fury coursed through Mary's veins.
Listen to me, darling. He's gone. He'll never touch you again.
At length, Emma whispered,
It burns.
I know, Mary said, relieved.
It was a beginning. All else, who the two men were, what Emma could tell them of their captors, had to wait.
I know it does, Emma. I can fix that. And the medicine will make you sleep so that you can rest. And when you want to, we can talk. She mixed a small amount of tincture of coral hydrate with some cider. Emma drank thirstily and lay back down. Mary stroked Emma's hair until the girl fell asleep under the spell of the sedative. From outside, the soft tunes of Elizabeth's violin underscored Claire's occasional chatter, and then her cries, as Claire, too, finally understood what Amelia had been trying to tell her. Chapter 27 Later, in response to a loud pounding at the front door, Mary slipped out of the lying-in room where Emma was still sleeping and leaned over the balustrade, peering into the foyer below, where William had opened the door and was speaking with someone. William was planning to go soon to the hospital to see Mr. Harley and their other patients, and earlier, Elizabeth had taken Claire to her room, and Amelia had just spelled Mary so that she could bathe and dress.
I just need a word.
Darlene? Mary said, registering the owner of that coarse, insistent thrum. Mary hurried down as Darlene rustled into the dark foyer in a swish of tawdry nighttime finery, a gown of blue satin that was iridescent even in the entryway's dull light. She was heaving with exertion. Mud streaked the hem of her shiny skirts. Several strands of hennaed hair had fallen from their pins and fringed her face in an uneven curtain. Despite Darlene's garish dress, her face lacked any hint of rouge or paint. Usually, she wore a great deal of the stuff. Even this past Thursday, when her wounds had been raw and weeping, she'd drawn kohl around her eyes. Now, her low square neckline revealed possibly more bosom than had ever been shown in public at noon in the city of Albany. She tugged self-consciously at the dress, but to no effect. It was made to reveal, not conceal. William flashed a glance at Mary that seemed to communicate that he feared locusts might rain down on them next. Darlene, with another ineffectual tug at her neckline, said,
I didn't get the right house at first. Some of your neighbors might be wondering about me.
The vision of the scandalously clad Darlene dashing from house to house in her opulent gown struck Mary in her exhaustion as laughable.
William, may I introduce Darlene?
I'm sorry, Darlene, I don't know your last name.
It's Moss.
How do you do? William said, then nodded and excused himself, leaving them alone.
He your husband?
Darlene asked, with a jerk of her head, eyeing William as he disappeared up the stairs.
Darlene, what is it? Are you all right? Is it your arms?
In response, Darlene thrust them out to show Mary that the slashes, no longer bandaged, were already knitting themselves back together.
I told your husband it's not about these.
Why, you've taken such good care, Mary said.
She took Darlene's arms in her hands and examined the wounds carefully, marveling that she had followed through on all she asked of her.
I apologize for barging in. I do, Darlene hurried on. Thing is, I ran all this way. Cut across fields and through the almshouse grounds to avoid the road. That's why I'm fagged, you see. I ran and ran.
You ran up the hill from downtown? Mary said. Why didn't you just take the horse car?
I didn't come from near the river. I'm in a new house now over on New Scotland, past Ontario, Darlene said. That other house was no good. Thursday, soon as I got back from clinic, with my cuts all bandaged and fixed, Madame fined me for getting cut, as if I'd slashed my own arms. Then she wouldn't pay me what I was owed. Another penalty, she said, for not having the good sense to dodge the razor. And when I complained, she busted out with a palaver of screaming and yelling. But I gave as good as I got, then skedaddled. I caught a ride on the back of some farmer's wagon. Paid him like he asked, out behind a tree.
Mary winced at this revelation, but Darlene dismissed it with a shake of her head.
Free is a lot cheaper than the horse car, and the conductors kick me off anyway, claiming I'm uncouth, even though I'm the picture of manners when I go out.
I'm not sure that it was actually free, Mary said. She was studying Darlene carefully, taking in her disarray, her fatigue.
Do you mind if I sit down? Darlene said. I'm still fagged.
Mary gestured toward the parlor, where the prostitute took in the furnishings, a collection of rather drab but serviceable armchairs and tables, an intentional choice, since the parlor served as the waiting room.
No offense, Darlene said, but it's all a sight unhappy, isn't it? We've had far nicer things in the houses I've worked.
Darlene?
Sorry. The new madam took me in right off. She didn't care about my cuts or the bugs in my hair, but she decided I oughtn't to service men till my arms got a little less weepy and I got my hair straightened around. Nice lady. She let me take care of myself. Said when I was ready I could start up again. Then, last night she said she'd thought of a way for me to pay my board right off. She took me back to her private room off the kitchen, where a man was laid out in her bed. He had a fat bandage on his neck. She said he was her friend and that I was supposed to take good care of him, 'cause she couldn't, 'cause she had to be out front all night. I was to give him food when he asked and dose him up good with liquor when he said he was hurting. She didn't have anything stronger, even though she said someone was supposed to have brought her some poppy syrup. She warned me not to say anything to anyone, and I did what she asked. I took care of him. Anyway, he was already half drunk when I found him, complaining about his neck and moaning.
That's why you're here? You need a doctor? Mary said, rising. Why didn't you just say? I'll tell William.
Darlene held up her hand, forestalling her.
To keep him quiet, he kept crying out. I asked him questions about how he'd gotten hurt, and lordy, did that man talk. He started complaining that some little boys just about drowned him in the flood. Then he got all mixed up. One minute he was talking about those boys, and the next he was clinging to my wrist and crying sorry about taking those sisters. And God, did he love them, and where were they, poor things, and he hoped they'd made it. Oh, my darling girls, he said that again and again. It took me a long time to figure out just what he was saying and who he might be saying it about. And then I knew. But I wanted to make sure, So I asked him a couple times, just vague-like, so I wouldn't scare him. Girls? What girls? Oh, angels they are, he said. I kept pressing him, and finally he came out with their names. Emma and Claire. I'm right, aren't I? Isn't that the name of your girls?
An icy chill shot up Mary's spine.
I think he's the one. The man who took your girls. And he's lying in a bed just down the road.
Mary stared at Darlene. Captain Mantell's warnings returned with a rush. He had said that Darlene would turn up, wanting money in exchange for information. And now here she was.
Didn't you hear me? Darlene said.
Did you say this man has a cut on his neck?
Yes. His neck was bandaged as neat as you like, and stitches. Looked as good as if you did it, come to think of it. But it was getting a bit bloody, just seeping, you know, so I used the soap you gave me on his cut. Seemed to help. But what I really wanted to do was to put my thumb in it to make him suffer.
Darlene's description of the man's injury sounded strikingly similar to James Harley's, whom she had left yesterday confined to his bed in City Hospital. Now she couldn't help but wonder whether Darlene had read the newspaper story about Harley and concocted this tale in hopes of profiting. But Darlene had not yet asked for a penny. Mary racked her memory of the terrible article. Sometime yesterday afternoon, after the delicate task of sewing up Emma, William had read her the reporter's patronizing drivel. Were it a time any less fraught, Mary would have penned a repudiation. But what had the reporter said about Harley? She recalled no description of his injury, just his name. What did this man say his name was?
He couldn't say. He was half out of his mind, sick with fever.
You didn't read yesterday's paper?
I can't read, Darlene said, exasperated. I told you that on Thursday.
She had, Mary recalled now, and banished any further question about Darlene's motives. What does he look like?
Head as bald as an eagle's, burly-like, hard and strong.
Harley, without a doubt. Mary sat back, her heart racing. She shut her eyes against the image of that man with Emma.
Dr. Stipp?
Darlene was peering at her.
Did he talk about anyone else? Another man, perhaps? No, just the girls. And those boys, I guess.
Does he live there? Darlene shrugged a bare shoulder, freed by the wide neckline of her dress.
I don't know. Can't say. Last night's the first time I spied him. Since I got there, I'd been out back in the damned laundry shed, rinsing my hair with that lice bane.
She combed a hand through a loose strand.
Though I tell you, if he came from somewhere else, he sure didn't get there by himself. The man isn't well enough to put one foot in front of the other. I wanted to come here right away, but I had to watch him. So I soaked him in more whiskey until he passed out. Near 2 in the morning, the madam came back. Then this morning, when I woke up, I bolted to come tell you. Slept in my dress and corset so I could get out quick. Of course, she added mournfully, none of any of this will tell you where those girls are. I asked and asked. All that man babbled on about was that accursed flood taking them away. Maybe your girls are all right. I hope they are. I wished I'd found them for you. But I think, oh, I should have said this earlier. Maybe they drowned. Maybe they didn't. But all that water. Oh, my heart aches for you thinking of it.
An excess of caution held Mary back from alerting Darlene to the fact of Emma's and Claire's survival. There were too many variables, too many things she did not yet understand. Darlene, would you be willing to tell my husband what you just told me? Darlene shrugged again.
Would have told you both if he'd stayed.
Vera did not blink at Darlene's colorful attire. She poured her a cup of coffee then disappeared into the kitchen, muttering something about eggs. As Darlene faithfully repeated the whole story to William, she ran her fingers appreciatively over the fine wool of a shawl Mary had unearthed for her. The unflappable Vera soon returned with a plateful of scrambled eggs and black bread slathered with butter, squeezing Darlene's wrist in a gesture of affection before retreating again. Vera never betrayed that she heard anything of what was said in the house, but she always knew everything. The other night, when she'd been weeping, no doubt she'd thought no one had heard her. Darlene ate her fill. William asked a few probing questions that Mary had not thought of. Was it possible that the man was mixing up the sex of the children, confused about the gender because he was ill? Had Darlene ever said the girls' names to him before he told them to her? Was she certain she had heard him correctly? Drunken men, he informed her, had a tendency toward ownership of other people's stories. Darlene scoffed at any suggestion that the vagaries of inebriated men were any kind of mystery to her, and she remained adamant. She knew what she'd heard. Mary and William exchanged an urgent, puzzled glance. Vera reappeared and demanded that Darlene turn over her shoes.
"Why?" Darlene said. "To clean them."
Darlene stared after Vera as she toted away her surrendered shoes. William and Mary hardly noticed the exchange, preoccupied with Darlene's news. William implored Darlene to say nothing of the man's disclosures to anyone. Could they count on her?
Of course. You ought to mind that the madam is with him now, and who knows what he'll say to her.
We are so grateful to you.
At least you know now who took them. And if they did go into the river, I'm ever so sorry. Now, will you do something for me? Darlene said.
Mary braced herself.
If you send the police, can you give me a shout before they come? I don't want to end up in the station house again. It's cold in those cells, and I'm never dressed for it. And I've no money this time to pay a bribe. They don't let you leave till you pay them something under the table. And so you know that Captain Mantell is the worst.
Mantell?
He's funny, that one. The things he asks for. He always pays well, but none of the girls like to work him.
Work him?
Come now, Dr. Stipp. You can't be shocked by anything now, can you? He's a rough one, too. Likes the young ones. I had a bruise or two from him myself upon a time.
Mary sat stunned. Captain Mantell, whom she had turned to for help. Why didn't you tell me this that day at the clinic?
That man's trouble. He might have been outside, listening.
She was wiping her face with a napkin and dusting breadcrumbs from her décolletage when Vera returned with the shoes.
They'll just get all muddy going back, Darlene said, slipping them on. But thanks all the same, and for the eggs.
Vera waved her hand and disappeared again. Darlene shrugged the shawl from her shoulders, but Mary insisted she keep it. A smile of gratitude crept across Darlene's face, and then she dashed out the back door, down the wooden steps, into the fenced garden, and through the gate to the alleyway, where Harold was shoeing one of the carriage horses, bent over the horse's rear fetlock. Mary watched Darlene's bouncing flight until she disappeared, then turned to William. Emma said there were two men.
The police captain?
William shook his head.
That's a leap. It can't be true.
I'm not sure what's true anymore. Chapter 28. In his scuffed helmet and muddied uniform, Colum Farrell looked a sweaty mess. Mary and William had gone looking for the policeman and found him on Broadway, patrolling for looters at the junction of Broadway and Steuben, where merchants and restaurateurs were shoveling mounds of river sludge into the gutters, piling sodden showcases and furniture onto the sidewalk to dry, and stacking crates of rescued goods high off the muck. Up and down Broadway, the thakada thakada of steam pumps percussed the air.